Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Good to be back.
Hello and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. And what we heard after that confirmed that President Joe Biden wants to turn the page on four decades of US tax cuts and talk of shrinking government, with a call for not just more government, but higher taxes to pay for it. He celebrated his first 100 days in office this week with yet another massive spending package, this one squarely aimed at taxing the rich to give money to everyone else. All told, he's proposed nearly $6 trillion in new spending since taking office, paid for by at least $4 trillion worth of higher tax revenues. Now, as it happens, the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, also met this week to consider its next move. Its policymakers looked at the ocean of new government spending coming down the track, the booming stock market, and the rapidly recovering US economy, and decided interest rates should stay at rock bottom, and that the bank should continue to push money into the economy at a rate of $120 billion a month. All in all, it seemed like a good time to consider whether we really are seeing a revolution in US economic policy under the man that Donald Trump used to call Sleepy Joe. A little later, we'll also hear why Americans, rich and poor, are retiring earlier these days, thanks to the pandemic. Now, that's the opposite of what we were told was going to happen, with the population aging and most of us expecting to work a lot longer. But first, let's have that talk about Biden's first 100 days and his big new plan for American families with two of Bloomberg's smartest analysts of US economic policy, Federal Reserve reporter Rich Miller and White House reporter Nancy Cook. Rich, Nancy, thank you very much for doing this in what I know has been a very busy week. Nancy, maybe just kicking off with you, can I ask you quickly just to tell me about the plan for American families and how it fits in with the president's other massive spending plans since becoming president?
Well, Stephanie, I think that's the key operative word, massive spending plans. This latest bill that he's talking about is a $1.8 trillion plan that includes $1 trillion of government spending and another $800 billion in tax cuts and credits for families. It's a very sweeping plan that would try to expand preschool access, access to community college, set up a national paid family leave program, expand and extend the child tax credit through 2025. It's really a liberal's wish list, and it comes on top of the other two major plans that Biden has proposed, the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, which has passed Congress, and then the infrastructure package, which is $2.25 trillion, which Congress hasn't even taken up yet. So basically, he is proposing about $6 trillion in spending in a very short period.
Yeah, and if you add, I mean, as you suggest, you know, if you add the $1.8 trillion for this package and then about two each for the short-term stimulus and infrastructure, I mean, you are talking real money. I mean, Rich, is it remotely realistic that all of that spending is really going to come through? I mean, where are the deficit hawks that we used to hear from?
Well, first of all, you got to remember the different time frames for these bills. The first one that Nancy was referring to is, you know, going to get spent very quickly. We already have, you know, the checks are in people's bank accounts and are being spent, judging by what we've seen with the trade deficit shooting up. But the other two packages are more longer term. The first one, the infrastructure one, is more of an 8-year plan, and the families one is more of a 10-year plan. So it's not all coming all at once. And as far as the deficit hawks, you can't see them in the markets. The Treasury yields went up a little bit, but now have come back down. You can't really, I mean, the Republicans are grousing a little bit about this, but with interest costs so low, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is saying now's the time to go big and we don't have to worry about the deficits.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that. I mean, philosophically, we remember that the Volcker-Reagan paradigm we had in the 80s, you know, not only the sort of tax cuts, small government philosophy of Ronald Reagan, but also Paul Volcker coming in as a very muscular anti-inflation central bank governor, and the two of them kind of defined an era. For you, I guess, Richard, it would be fair to say you don't quite go back to the Volcker Fed, but you certainly have been around the block for a while. You know, it's not overstating it to say this is overturning a very long time paradigm, but not just the role of the government, but also the central bank.
Yeah, I think it's right. Volcker and Reagan together, you know, there was a tremendous change in the way in the economy went from the government to the markets. The emphasis was on efficiency, not equality, and the power also went from labor to the owners of capital, and it was monetary policy that was premier, not fiscal policy. And all of that we're seeing, you know, turned on its head. You know, Volcker wanted to get inflation down. Powell wants to get inflation up.
I mean, and Nancy, we just heard there about raising efficiency. If you look at these packages together, particularly, I guess, the Infrastructure and the Families Act, you know, how much of it is about raising the growth rate, making the economy stronger, and how much is just classic redistributive big government?
I think that the first plan, the COVID relief plan, was really about raising the growth rate and making sure that the economy could crawl out of the hole from COVID-19. I think these next two packages, the Families Plan and the Infrastructure Plan, are really huge government programs that are trying to reshape and reorient the economy in a completely different way. They're trying to redistribute some of the wealth that we saw, you know, rich people gain during the pandemic. They are trying to give money to communities like African-American communities that have typically had more of a wealth gap. They're trying to create new jobs in clean energy, raise the wages of workers for things like home health care aides and child care workers. And so it really is a massive government program to try to reshape the economy for what the Biden White House argues is sort of the things we need to do to prepare for climate change and to make sure that there's a stable middle class. Of course, Republicans are very against these ideas. And the two parties are interestingly sort of going back to their most extreme positions, where, you know, Democrats are really proposing some of the most sweeping redistributive policies that we've seen in decades, whereas Republicans are going back to many of their old arguments, not about the deficit, as you and Rich have talked about, but about the need for small government, you know, keeping tax cuts in place. It just shows how polarized the politics are on the future of the economy.
But how about the politics of this, though? I noticed with the infrastructure bill that, you know, a lot of it's paid for, in theory, by raising taxes on companies and business. And that seemed to be quite popular with the broader public. Can the same be said of some of these efforts to increase taxes on the very wealthy? If you're just fixing on how much people can inherit, who are in the highest bit of the income scale, and sort of closing loopholes for the super wealthy, I mean, isn't that quite politically popular?
That's also politically popular. There has been a raft of polling done in the last several months that show that, you know, raising taxes on rich people, raising taxes on capital gains, these are things that gained so much political traction during the 2020 presidential campaign. And one thing that the Biden White House really has going for them is they are proposing dramatic tax changes, but those tax changes are not as dramatic as the ideas that, let's say, Senator Elizabeth Warren put out during the campaign or Senator Bernie Sanders. And the White House feels like they do have some political cover because they can say to, you know, more moderate Democrats and Republicans, look, we're not going as far as some wings of the party wanted. And they're trying to make the argument that wealthy people gained so much during the pandemic, you know, it's time to make them pay their fair share.
How much of this actually has any chance of becoming law?
Well, I think that that's the key question. People that I talk to think that these two bills are huge and they're such big asks of Congress. Most people I speak to think that ultimately these two packages will be condensed into one package and a lot of the things will be taken out, particularly things from the American Families Plan, like potentially the paid leave aspect or, universal preschool. I think there's a lot of bipartisan interest in doing things like infrastructure, rebuilding roads and bridges in the U.S. and spending money that way. I think some of the components of the Families Plan will be a much tougher lift politically.
And Rich, just thinking about the economics of this, I mean, there's some bits of the US tax code which to outsiders seem extraordinary. I mean, the fact that when people die, when, you know, someone very rich dies and their heirs inherit, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, all of the capital gains on those get kind of counted in the inheritance and you can sort of start at scratch if you're the person inheriting it. The fact that people would just never pay any tax on any of that of those capital gains seems crazy to outsiders, even countries that have relatively lower tax rates. I mean, there is an economic case for some of these changes.
Oh, there's definitely an economic case for some of these changes. Not so much on the inheritance tax, which, of course, the Republicans tried to rebrand as the death tax and actually probably succeeded in doing. But on some of the changes like increasing educational opportunities, expanding child care, all of that is aimed at both increasing the size of the labor force, but also increasing the skills of the labor force. And that's aimed at lifting this sort of long-term potential growth rate of the economy. Likewise with the public infrastructure. It's you know, improving roads, improving broadband, so that you improve productivity and therefore improve the potential growth rate of the economy. So while Nancy was right in saying, you know, a lot of this focus is on redistribution, there is an argument they're making sort of a little more sotto voce that this is going to lift the long-term potential growth rate of the economy.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
And you have Janet Yellen there, who was at the Fed and is now Treasury Secretary. She used to have to worry about inflation. In theory, the Treasury Secretary doesn't worry so much about inflation, but this surely has to be a concern if you're looking at all of that spending and borrowing going down the track, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, the White House has gone out of its way to make clear that this is something they're watching very, very carefully. The Council on Economic Advisers took the unusual step of putting out a blog post taking apart the arguments of people like Larry Summers on about inflation. But I think in the end, you know, if we do get inflation, Janet Yellen recognizes as a former Fed it's going to be up to the Fed to control it. Fiscal policy is not nimble enough, and all these fiscal, you know, depending on how much gets done, all this fiscal policies will be in train, all this spending will be in train. And if we get inflation and there's needs to be something done about it, it's going to be the Fed and Jay Powell or whoever his successor is job to make sure it doesn't get out of control.
And we had the novel backdrop for the State of the Union of two women sitting behind the president, the leader of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and the vice president. You've got a lot of chairs changing at the Fed in the next year or so, including the reappointment or not of Jay Powell as the chairman. Do you think President Biden's going to want to make the US central bank look different as well? Put in some different faces, maybe different color faces?
Thanks for putting me on the spot, Stephanie. I don't know. On the one hand, it's hard to conceive of a more dovish central bank chairman than we have now in Jay Powell. That argues for keeping him in place. On the other hand, there's a progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which is going to be pushing hard for someone, as you say, maybe you know, a woman or maybe African American, or
so that would be the first black chairman of the Fed.
For sure. And while Powell has, you know, probably more than exceeded Democrats' wishes when it comes to monetary policy, he's been more friendly, I would say, to some changes on the loosening the regulations on the banks. And you know, you have people like Senator Elizabeth Warren who really want to keep their thumbs on the banks and maybe do even more and attack private equity, et cetera. So that one I'd argue for replacing him. But, I mean, it's probably going to come down to a decision later this year. If the economy is going swimmingly well, as a lot of people expect, it might be easier to replace him.
So just stepping back, finally, you know, we always focus, rightly or wrongly, on the first 100 days. Relative to your expectations, you know, you've both been in Washington a long time. How would you rate President Biden's first 100 days? He certainly spent a lot of money, or tried to spend a lot of money, but any surprises? Nancy?
I think that his first 100 days have gone well. I think that even his critics would say that they have gone well, because he basically did two of the key things that he needed to do, which is, you know, inject a bunch of money into the economy to try to improve growth, to try to improve unemployment, to make sure that, you know, families have stable financial footing. And then he's done a good job. He and his team have done a good job of getting the pandemic under control, ramping up the vaccination rate. And so the first 100 days have really been dealing with these crises. I think what has surprised me and many other political reporters is just how progressive and revolutionary his agenda has been. President Biden has always been seen as a real centrist, a creature of the Senate, an institutionalist. He did not run a 2020 campaign that anyone saw as hugely progressive. That all that attention went to Senator Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. And yet, once he has gotten into the White House, he has pursued policies that have shocked progressives and delighted them. And it's just much more of an ambitious, sweeping agenda in line with really the most progressive wing of the party than I think Democrats thought was possible.
Just before we get to Rich, I just wanted, it is interesting that, and that's obviously it's been striking to a lot of people. I guess that you could argue that if most of it's not going to get passed in this Senate, that this is, you know, that he doesn't really believe this, and this is all gesturing, this is all just sort of getting the left off his back.
I think there's some truth to that with the American Families Plan, this most recent plan. I don't think that I've been told that his heart is not as in this plan as it is with infrastructure. But I do think that he feels very strongly about the infrastructure package. I think that he feels very strongly that they needed to pass the $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan. The families plan, they unveiled a third because it is the last priority for the White House. And I think that plan is much more of one that has less support in the West Wing, or a bit more of a divided support among his top advisors and even from the president. And that is seen as something to get progressives off his back.
And Rich Miller, What do you think of the first 100 days? And is anything, have you been surprised by Biden's radicalism or anything else?
I mean, I think I've been a bit surprised by his radicalism. But if you go back to the actual proposals that he laid out during the campaign, he is following along with many of them. I mean, if you go back and read the literature that was, you know, he was putting out at the time, even though he came across, as Nancy said, compared to Warren and Sanders as a centrist, his proposals were pretty radical. I think maybe one thing that he might have learned from President Trump is if you promise something, try to deliver it. And I think that's what he's trying to do. And that's whether, as you and Nancy pointed out, whether, you know, especially with the second two packages, it turns out to be more aspirational than actual, you know, remains to be seen. But I think he did campaign with a pretty progressive platform. Maybe the rhetoric wasn't new. The rhetoric was more, I'm, you know, going to cooperate with Republicans, etc. But if you actually read the proposals, there was a hell of a lot of spending he was putting out there.
Interesting. Well, in 100 days, maybe we'll come back and see how much more money he's tried to spend. But in the meantime, Nancy Cook, Rich Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And now I wanted to bring you a different take on the recovery from US economy reporter Mike Sasso in Atlanta, who together with his colleague Alex Tanzi has been taking a look at why so many people at different ends of the US labour market are deciding 2021 is a good time to retire.
Economists speak of a K-shaped recovery in the United States, so named because many Americans with office jobs fared well during the COVID-19 recession, and their fates resemble the upward slope of the letter K. Many others in the travel and restaurant industries have fared poorly, though, and occupy the downward slope. That same dynamic is occurring in retirement. The pandemic has sparked a retirement rush of sorts in the U.S., at least among those fortunate enough to have built up their savings and investments. A soaring stock market has boosted their retirement accounts, while the pandemic caused many to reevaluate their priorities in life. In Massachusetts, Melissa Martini put away her business outfits for good at the end of March. She's retiring 5 years earlier than she expected from her job as an administrator for the agency that oversees the Massachusetts parks.
I'm 58 right now, and had it not been for the stresses of the pandemic and the cuts in my staff, I probably would have stayed in my position another 5 years. But I was looking at retiring probably at 62 or 63. I've seen so many people who have decided to wait too long to retire. And, you know, many of my colleagues or older family members, and they get 1 year of retirement and then they get sick and they pass on. And it's just, I don't want that for myself.
Traditionally, Americans have waited to retire until they at least reach their mid-60s. That's when most are eligible for full retirement benefits from the Social Security Administration. The pandemic, however, has upended that thinking for the fortunate ones. After the global financial crisis of 2007, the U.S. stock market took more than 5 years to recover its losses. In this pandemic recession, it took only 7 months. Many are getting out while the getting's still good. While the pandemic caused some Americans to delay applying for their Social Security retirement benefits, overall it caused a net increase of 1.7 million applications, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Some of those people retired willingly, others lost their jobs and see little hope of getting a new one. Martini chose to retire after the state of Massachusetts kept cutting her subordinates during the pandemic, leaving her with too much work and too little time.
It just was too much stress, too much responsibility to really handle without the resources. So my husband and I looked at our investments and our finances, and we decided, you know what, I can survive on my state pension, 30% of my pay for the rest of my life, because our investments were such that we could afford for me to do that.
6 years ago, she and her husband bought a 42-foot sailboat. He's also retiring early, and they plan to put it to good use.
And we're hoping that at some point in the future, when we're not worried about aging parents, we will be able to sail to the Caribbean in the wintertime and live on the boat for, you know, the winter months in the Virgin Islands, probably.
To be sure, economists will spend years researching this most unusual recession and its K-shaped recovery. While some recent national surveys suggest people are retiring early, others are being left behind. A recent survey from the Employee Benefits Research Institute suggests the pandemic, in net terms, prompted more U.S. workers to delay retirement than to speed it up. It cited job losses and other stresses. Ultimately, the pandemic helps to shed more light on the gap between America's haves and its have-nots.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So I'm delighted to talk now to Alex Tanzi, a senior editor for the Real Economy team in Washington, who worked with Mike pulling together some data to go with the story, but has also been thinking about broader question of generational inequality. We tend to think that the last few years have not been great to young people relative to old. And it was sort of symbolized in that piece by the fact that you have older Americans actually able to retire sooner than they thought because of how well the stock market has done. I mean, Alex, do you have a sense that the pandemic has worsened generational inequality?
The pandemic has, across the board, has created this K-shaped recovery. So there's millennials and younger people that are doing exceptionally well, people that had a job and kept their job. But at the same time, many people in that age cohort, you know, had service sector jobs and lost their jobs. So it's a mixed picture. It's very nuanced.
But you did find some interesting data that suggested that the wealth gap might even be closing in some parts of the labor market.
That's right. So the St. Louis Federal Reserve did a report, and they're showing that the wealth gap for millennials is getting a little bit better. At one point, they were calling it the lost generation, but now they're showing that while they're still less wealthy than they were expected to be at this age, they're closing the gap. And the oldest millennials are, you know, they're approaching 40. So they're not exactly super young anymore, but they are gaining wealth and they are purchasing real estate. And the real estate market's done exceptionally well in the U.S. this year. So they have received equity gains in their real estate holdings. And also, the stock market obviously has done quite well. If I annualize the last three quarters of 2020, people under the age of 40 saw their biggest wealth gain ever of any cohort at any time. So they had a 17% annualized increase in the last three quarters of 2020, which was better than any other group has done at any other time.
I'm just trying to think through the logic of that, because obviously if they have less money, it's more that they were able to have the biggest percentage increase. But in absolute terms, the older generations are still really the ones who are sitting on a big chunk of the wealth, surely.
That's exactly right. Millennials did see their assets swell to over $10 trillion. But at the same time, you know, for example, baby boomers have seven times that much. So millennials also hold quite a bit of debt, and the type of debt they hold isn't exactly the, you know, so-called good debt. They are purchasing more real estate, which, you know.
What's good debt? Remind me what good debt is.
Usually mortgage debt is considered good because it's an appreciating asset most of the time. But millennials tend to hold quite a bit of consumer debt, which is credit card debt. So, for example, you know, like I just mentioned, baby boomers have 7 times the assets as millennials, but baby boomers have less debt. So millennials have 50% more debt than baby boomers. And, you know, one type of that debt that's been making the news quite a bit is student loans, which has just gone up by astronomical amounts in the last decade or so.
And we were earlier in the program, we've been touching on the potential for inflation. If there's a younger generation, as you point out, the younger generation isn't necessarily millennials anymore. It's below younger than that. That's sitting on a lot of debt, which is not tied to rising assets. What does inflation mean for them? I mean, we tend to think that inflation is not so bad for debtors because it sort of inflates away the value of the debt, but I guess they'd also be paying higher interest rates.
Definitely be paying higher interest rates. That's probably one of the biggest reasons for pessimism because wage gains really haven't been there. So if the other side of the coin starts to increase a lot, if their debt payments or debt service costs increases rapidly, it's going to put quite a bind on their disposable income. One problem, you know, in the past, people have always said, you know, a college education is needed and you can't really succeed without it. But at the same time, more and more people are receiving a degree. So the value of a college degree is going down while the prices are going up. So they've gone into quite a bit of debt to acquire a college degree that depreciates in value.
Well, it's one of those things that raises the stakes if and when interest rates do go up, because you're going to have these very disparate effects on different bits of the population. Alex Tansey, that's fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So that's it for this episode of Stephanomics. I'll be back next week with more from around the world. In the meantime, please, if you could take the time to rate the show, it would help us broaden our reach. For more news and analysis from Bloomberg Economics during the week, follow @economics on Twitter. This episode was produced, as ever, by Magnus Henriksen, with special thanks to Mike Sasso, Alex Tansey, Rich Miller and Nancy Cook. Lucy Meakin is the executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.